Without further ado, let me introduce the first speaker. It's Colin Ledley. He's asked me to be particularly brief about what I say about him. He is the Chief Risk Officer of Standard Life and has been since January 2007. Previously, he was the appointed actuary. He's a member of Faculty Council and he's the Chairman of the Enterprise Risk Management Professional
Practice.
Practice Executive. Thank you. I'm also part of that committee, just shows. Colin, yeah, let me turn it over to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I asked Jules to keep it brief because I thought it would be useful for me to give a bit of background about the company I work in, Standard Life. Most of you will be familiar with the organisation, but perhaps useful just to paint a picture of the main parts of the organisation and how enterprise risk management fits in with an organisation of that type, and a bit of the background about the sort of history that I have that's brought me to the CRO role over the last couple of years. So Standard Life, as you know, is a large life assurance company based largely in the UK. Most of our business is in one country, the United Kingdom. Demutualized a short time ago, and feels like a long time ago now that we've been a PLC. We've got a number of different parts of the group and subsidiaries that are quite significant, although inevitably dominated by the traditional life assurance business. But we've got a big Canadian business, which is number four in that market. We've got growing businesses in Asia, in India and China in particular. We've got a small general insurance business, writing healthcare business in the south of England. And we've got a bank, which has been fun over the last 6 to 9 months. Relatively small, but of the order of 10 billion of assets and liabilities. I've been with Standard Life all my career in a number of different roles. I've worked in the marketing area, I've worked in the actuarial area. International theme has been quite large in my career, where I've worked a number of different international roles over the years, and was latterly in the appointed actuary role, and that evolved into head of actuarial function and with Profits Actuary before, just after demutualization, I grabbed the opportunity to move into the risk area, feeling that that would be an interesting growing area and one of increasing influence in the group, and have been delighted with the change that I've made since then. It has been a fascinating role and very different, as I'll hopefully demonstrate, from the traditional actuarial role. So what does a CRO get up to? Well, a whole range of different activities, some of them very familiar to the actuary. Financial risk management is probably the core activity that actuaries are familiar with, where my background, I think, will be most valuable and where I'm, let's say, on home territory. The traditional appointed actuary role picks up very much a financial risk management role, communicating to the board the main risks of the organisation, and we as professionals have had training in that particular role over our whole careers. We've seen techniques like the ICA developed, and that again is very much the sort of activity that the CRO gets involved with, the economic capital models, looking at all the risks in the organisation. In the last year, particularly projects for myself have been getting involved with financial risk management hedging, working with teams in our investment area and the actuarial teams to hedge our financial risks. We had a very large reinsurance treaty during the year for a $6 billion annuity book. Again, the risk management team of actuaries within the risk management function and within the life business heavily involved in that activity. And a lot of focus on setting the appetite for risk. We have in place, as you would expect, a range of risk appetite statements for all the major financial risks, quantified on an ICA-type basis. And I think a focus over the next year will be to broaden that out and start focusing our risk appetite statements on a broader range of measures, particularly earnings statements and cash flow measures, which I think will bring to life for the board the appetite statements, which at the 1 in 200 level are perhaps somewhat remote for them. The next two things where the risk management function gets engaged are in capital management and allocation. and in risk-adjusted performance metrics. And these become, I think, the more advanced aspects of financial risk management. And they start to be areas where working very closely with other disciplines becomes essential. The broader finance team very much has a say in these areas, in the metrics that are used. But the risk management team is particularly interested in trying to embed the risk aspect of performance and driving towards using risk-adjusted returns and metrics wherever possible. And that's often quite a long journey to actually fully embed those aspects within the management of the organisation, especially when the metrics used by the market at the moment may not embed risk to the same degree as the risk management function might desire. Operational risk is a major element of the role, and developing that framework. We in the organisation have a detailed process in place which looks at the range of operational risks across the organisation, trying to control, identify, anticipate a range of key performance indicators. And just as an example of activities during the past year, one example was when we used the operational risk framework to identify an increase in the level of operational losses that had occurred. There were a lot of write-offs happening of financial amounts, and further investigation as a result of that led to an identification that things were being signed off at too low a level in the organisation, which led to action to increase the level of sign-off to more senior management and put a better control in place of those aspects within the framework. We have strategic risk management. A key role for the CRO is to really get engaged with the strategic planning process in the organisation and embed consideration within strategic plans at an early stage of the key strategic risks. And that's a challenge to engage senior management in thinking about the range of risks they're exposed to, what might go wrong with a strategy, what are the challenges to their strategy. And I think to embed adverse scenarios within the planning process sufficiently early so that they actually can make a difference rather than coming right at the end of the process, which is a risk. Emerging risk management, another important theme, trying to anticipate events that might occur, looking at more extreme events that might hit organisations. An example of that was using external events like the events at Société Générale, and we in the company set up a review following that, and that led to a number of findings. Our exposure is very different from a large investment bank, but some of the themes within our investment department led to identification of operational improvements that could be made. Increasingly, within the risk framework, the compliance function is also found, and within my remit I've got both a risk team and a compliance team, and working closely with the regulator, an important role within that. And I think many actuaries probably know from experience that the actuarial department probably engages with the regulator more than many other functions within an organisation, and certainly an experience I had previously of working through the demutualisation, being very familiar with working with the FSA. And compliance increasingly seen as just another risk and fitting within the risk framework of the organisation. Major theme during the year has been TCF and principles-based regulation, again heavily involved with all the TCF activities in the organisation and trying to meet the requirements of the FSA in that area. And then a number of areas which are less familiar to the actuary, but I think prove fascinating to the Chief Risk Officer. Financial crime comes directly within my current remit, a fascinating area given the number of attacks that an organisation like ourselves or any major financial institution is under from a variety of sources trying to extract money out of the organisation. Information security, another area that has been a significant focus, not a direct responsibility of mine in terms of the operational activity which sits elsewhere, but very much a key risk that we have and a constant topic within the risk management forums across the organisation. And we recognised over the last year, I think like many organisations, that the extent to which organisations are being attacked from outside and indeed from inside, the need for good internal controls and management of that activity is increasingly important. And finally, business continuity, another element of the overall framework. In terms of enterprise risk management, I've used this definition, which is the COSO definition of ERM. And having worked in the role, I think one of the things that struck me early on is the need to think about ERM as a process and almost to think of it as a system. Actuaries quite often focus on solutions to problems. And I think when you look at enterprise risk management, it's really a complex web of different processes that you have in the organisation that you're using to identify and action potential risks that you have within the organisation. So I think that process view and defining a process, and it's almost putting together all the different elements within that complex process that deliver the value from the ERM process for the organisation. And a number of models exist. For those that were able to attend the recent sessional meeting on ERM, I think that set out very clearly the range of different models that are used across the risk management world, picking up on governance aspects, a very important element, the controls that the board puts in place in terms of risk management, activities to identify risks and then to manage them. Risk appetite, a core element of the process and probably the most useful mechanism to really engage with senior management and to communicate with them about the risks that they tolerate and how they want to see the risk strategy evolve over time. And I think at present the tendency has been to set risk appetites at the tail of the distribution of potential events. And increasingly, I'm finding it more useful to start moving towards talking about less unlikely events, either a 1 in 5 year type event or a 1 in 10 year event, and use that as a tool for engaging with the board about the sorts of events and the sorts of losses that they would be prepared to see in the typical life cycle of, say, a finance director or a chief executive, rather than the 1 in 200 year event, which becomes quite difficult for the senior management and the board to appreciate. Any process, however, in ERM can only ever give reasonable assurance in terms of the outcome of loss. There will always be losses that occur. And I think ultimately I see the success that I would bring to the role as making sure that any losses that we do incur don't really come as a great surprise. There are going to be losses. Many of the risks that we run, for example, longevity risk, we have no control over as an organisation. We will at some point in the future, I'm sure, have a strengthening of reserves which will lead through to a loss. But hopefully all of the senior management of the organisation and stakeholders in the organisation will understand that we've got that exposure and will, in a sense, forgive us for any loss that might occur in that area. I think the challenge comes when there are surprises, which may be in the operational risk front or in the reputational area, where an event occurs that was a surprise to everybody and leads to real damage to the organisation and its reputation. Talking then of the challenges in the role over the last 18 months or so that I've been doing it, it has been an interesting time. The credit crunch has hit many organisations. Roger may talk about that later in terms of the banking background and seeing what his colleagues in the bank have seen in terms of the impact of the credit crunch. Standard Life certainly hasn't been immune from that, in that we have, a relatively small bank within the group, and funding of that bank has become increasingly difficult. We certainly anticipated liquidity risk as a significant risk that was important to us in our risk management framework, but I can't say that we foresaw in any sense the sorts of events that have occurred over the last 9 months. The positives, I guess, which many organisations would be able to feel, is that they did have a range of risk management policies that were designed to help them deal with and manage liquidity issues. For example, a policy about the range of funding sources that should be available to the organisation, and some of those remained available throughout the period, but a significant proportion became more difficult to tap. We've also had the issues that came as a result of that in terms of a number of assets became much less liquid than they previously were, and that's had an impact on a number of funds that we've had to manage over the course of the last 6 months. So thankfully not a big impact on our own organisation, but something that has kept many of us busy over that period of time. One aspect of the CR role, our role, I think, is that everybody brings you their problems. They never bring you the good news. You are the repository in the organisation for everything that has gone wrong. You're the first port of call with a whole range of issues. And I think you see more than any other function in the organisation all the challenges and issues that happen, which any one area may not see on their own. And that's a tremendously powerful or useful position to be in terms of getting that complete view. And if you can start drawing the connections between the different issues that are emerging, trying to pick up themes which one business unit might feel, well, we've had one issue here, no big deal. But if you're seeing it across the whole organisation and pulling those together, then you're getting themes which may identify areas that you need to action as an organisation. And issues will inevitably happen, I think. It's going to be part and parcel of the role, trying to manage those and find solutions quickly. And the risk management team inevitably engages with the business areas trying to work towards a sensible solution, managing the regulatory dialogue on those issues and making sure the right sort of escalations happen. Because I think one of the key things I've learned in the last 5 years of my career is that bringing things to light for the most senior management in the organisation and getting all the right people with the right skills to tackle a problem can make such a big difference to even the most seemingly intractable problem very, very quickly. Whereas if you let things fester, or if you've got an organisation which isn't open about issues and tries to bury them and solve them locally, and there's a sense of fear about bringing things forward for solution, then I think they just can build, grow, get worse, and when they actually do emerge, then you've got a much bigger issue than it needed to be. So getting that effective issue management with the right people dealing with things is critical. Operational risk management has been quite a big theme over the last 9 months for myself and the organisation. We implemented a major change to our operational risk framework 2.5 years ago, at the time of the company's IPO, and it's now needing a refresh. Things move on, and we've recognised that not all aspects are working exactly as we would like, so it's pushing that forward to the next degree. And I think the key element of it is it's a process which touches more people in the organisation perhaps than any other. We're asking every function, department in the organisation to go through effectively an operational risk management process, looking at the controls in their area, looking at the effectiveness of those controls. And that's where the risk management team really needs to be on top form as far as communication with the organisation is concerned, and driving as much value out of that process as possible and making the organisation feel that this risk management thing isn't just something they do to keep the risk managers happy, but something that actually adds value to their part of the business. Solvency II, I need to mention, I'm sure we'll talk about that again later in the evening. It's still early days for that, and my risk team working very closely with the life assurance team on that, working through the various quantitative impact studies at the moment. It feels a long way yet, but I think the role that the risk management function has in delivering what is required for Solvency II, making the internal model effective, is absolutely critical. And hence it will be a continuing theme for us over the next year or two. ERM development and developing our framework. So I would like to think we've got a pretty robust and complete framework in place in the organisation that operates in a pretty coherent manner that lets the organisation pick up and manage all the risks, but that inevitably needs to move forward over time and have further enhancements. And I think it's embedding some of the what in some of the frameworks would be called the strategic elements is where we need to do that, looking at the capital management aspects and the risk adjusted returns and embedding that within the organisation. We've got lots of good data and information across the organisation, but it's not yet fully embedded in the way I would like to see it. And I think a challenge for any group function, again, perhaps Roger will pick this one up from the other side, being in one of the business units at HBOS, is the relationship between a group function and the business units. And as an organisation, we're going through some changes at the moment in terms of the business strategy that we have, and I think inevitably the role of group versus business unit functions depends on that strategy and how the organisation is seeing itself. It's an entirety. Risk management needs to follow what is happening elsewhere in the organisation. But inevitably a source of some tension at times between what happens in the individual units and the definition of the various levels of risk management and the lines of defence. Where does the first line end and the second line end? And I think a need for clarity on that. Finally, going to finish off my section just talking a little bit about actuaries and the CRO. What does an actuary bring to the role, and what are the challenges for an actuary? Well, certainly a lot of strengths I think we bring. I said earlier on our home territory is financial risk management. We've got a very good intuitive feel for the big risks and the financial risks, and that's a real skill that we bring that perhaps many other professionals don't have quite the same depth of knowledge and understanding in the insurance business have. And I think generally I would like to think that I know the business very well, know the industry very well, and I think a lot of my actuarial colleagues have that same understanding and awareness of insurance-specific business because we've spent a lot of time being educated on insurance-specific activity. And we've got a very strong understanding of some of the more advanced techniques within risk management and a real thirst for knowledge in those areas. And I think an ability to really be at the cutting edge of risk management with the right skill and intellectual ability to engage with that. And finally, judgment, independence. A lot of the actuarial training has been around the right communication. It's around an aspect of policyholder protection in what the actuary does in terms of the setting of prudent reserves, the education that's brought that, and the evolution of roles like the with-profits actuary bring a degree of independence of judgment that is very valuable to the chief risk officer role, where very often the board will be looking for a different perspective from the CRO to many of the line management. And I think the CRO does need to have the courage to give that different view from times, because often line management will inevitably be more bullish than perhaps the risk officer, who is always looking for the challenges and perhaps the areas that could go wrong. The challenges then that I've seen in the role, one is the wider range of risks that you need to deal with compared to the actuarial role. As an actuary, I think the focus was on seeing the big picture, thinking about the big risks and perhaps ignoring the little risks. And I think the CRO role, a term that I picked up at a conference elsewhere, was ERM, everything really matters. And I think that's something I really do believe as a CRO, that everything does matter, and even the small things you need to pay attention to. Now, maybe an information security leak or issue may not in itself be enough to bring down an organisation, but I think, A, it can be a sign of poor management across the organisation if you're managing these things poorly, but it can also be the catalyst that turns a potentially difficult issue into a disaster. If you've got issues in the organisation that you need to communicate in an effective way to the outside world, it may not be good news, but if you're in control of the communication, you can hopefully get a much better outcome than if there is a leak of information in some way, and that can potentially lead to mishandling of the situation and much worse consequences. So I think everything really matters, and that focus, which is somewhat counter to the training that I've had, I think is very important. A very wide range of business relationships is important. Perhaps in the traditional actuarial role, you will be quite focused in a rather technical area with the CRO role and ERM. I think that connection across a very wide range of functions is absolutely critical. The need to communicate to senior management in a wide range of parts of the business, the importance of risk management, getting them engaged with the subject, getting them thinking about the risks to their business and getting buy-in to the process, but also demonstrating that you understand their business is very important as well, and that you do have a feel for what their issues are. Multidisciplinary teams are very important. Again, as I said, a lot of the activities that fall within my remit are not things that actuaries have any training to do, and the team that needs to be built needs to come from a wide range of disciplines. Actuaries will have great skills in a number of specific areas. Their training and background probably leaves them a little bit vulnerable in certain areas. So getting the right balance and mix of teams is essential. And if actuaries want to pick up other aspects of the ERM role, I think that's something they can evolve into and train themselves up in over time. And certainly as I built the team, it's an interesting line that we've got in the organisation. We've got an actuary at the top who's got an accountant reporting into him, who's got an actuary reporting in, who's got an accountant, who's got an actuary. And a lot of different backgrounds there as well, some from the treasury sector, which has been really helpful. Working in cash management has proved to be absolutely invaluable over the last 12 months to have people from that background to really supplement perhaps the actuary's knowledge of market risk, insurance risk, with people that really know credit risk really well. I've mentioned the next point before, a process and a systems view, and I think when you pull the whole ERM framework together, I think you do need to see things as a process or a working system with lots of different elements that need to work cooperatively together, and it's all the different elements that make a whole. You start seeing connections, as I was saying earlier, between different reporting mechanisms across the organisation. You may be getting reports from your internal auditors about particular control issues. You may be getting control self-assessment within the functions, identifying issues that are coming up to you. You're seeing external events being reported that are in the same area. And all these sources of different information tell you as a CRO, here is an area with elevated risk that you need to be focusing on and developing mitigation strategies to manage those risks. And finally, managing conflicts, and it probably goes back to the judgment and independence aspect. At the end of the day, it is a role where you need to work with a wide range of different areas, but you need to have confidence and trust in your own judgment in a number of areas, because you will get, challenges with the business taking a particular view and wanting to achieve a particular outcome, and you need to really take a stand and really identify for more senior management the issues. And I think that's I see the role. I will not have the answer or the ultimate call in these issues, but if there's something I feel uncomfortable with, then it's a process of letting the board, the senior management, know there's an issue there that they need to be making the call on, and you need to manage that process well. So with that, I think I will hand over to Roger.
Thank you, Colin. Apologies for those of you who are expecting someone else. We'll hopefully give sufficiently different to Colin to make it worth my while being here. Essentially, my formal title is Head of Group Insurance and Investment Risk, and I work for HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland. We are a large bank with also a quite large insurance operation attached, although our colleagues at the FSA seem to forget our size at times. We're top five on both life and household in the UK. You could doubtless debate whether a precise ranking, depending on how you do it, but that's roughly where we fit. So we're large. Also, very interestingly, working in a bank, the banking philosophy dominates everything. And so, in spite of the fact you sort of come in as an insurer, life insurer at that, essentially saying, well, this is the way to do it. And the bankers actually do many things very well. Things they can't do well is understand life insurance at all, and with-profit funds are totally beyond them. Even the sort of remarkably bright people in the Treasury Department who can sort of do hedges in their heads as mental arithmetic, with-profit funds throw them totally. So it's careful explanation required there. But also the way that the bank is structured and lays out its risk is interesting. I think what we do is consistent with Lloyd's and RBS, having met my counterparts there. A bit of a scary one there, but this is taken from our annual report and just shows where sort of risk fits. But crucially, this is to show we have what we call three lines of defence for our risk, which is sort of a sort of generic way of looking at it, but it makes one realise one's place. First line of defence is basically the divisions who have to know what they're doing, they have to know their risk, identify the risks, what's their appetite, manage them, mitigate them accordingly. There's total accountability there. So that's the first line of defence. Divisional chief executives, supported by divisional risk committees. As an aside, I'm not sure if risk is embedded in the business that you should actually have a divisional risk committee, but that's for discussion afterwards. There's then sort of a second line of defence, which is very much of group risk control, right? I sit in group risk, so Colin, I'm actually part of group, I'm not part of division, but have many years before I joined this, took this role on where I was a division and knew what I didn't like from group. So in this one, we've sort of split it up in various ways, and at the top, you've got the sort of group finance director control committees, you've got the group risk director controlled ones at the bottom, and there's various overlaps. I think we seem to have managed this sort of split between the group risk director and the group finance director treading on each other's toes reasonably okay. Because if you're a pure theorist, you'll argue, well, the group risk director is going to control risk capital. Since that's soon going to become reg capital, it actually is that for a bank currently, then surely why doesn't that become the group finance director? I know that many structures in insurance groups have... Some finance directors realise this, so the group risk director reports them. Others realise it, but they're alongside them, and there's potential clashes there. You can work alongside each other. The third line of defence on the right-hand side is then audit committees, external audit, group internal audit, and what we call divisional risk control committees. So in the group risk role, we're in the middle. The middle is a hard place to be because you kind of get squeezed from both sides, and it's easy to jump into either of the extremes. It's not our job to act as temporary resource for the divisions, much as though at times they like to think we can do that. It's not our job to do group internal audit or the external auditor's work, although again, you can easily drop into that role. We're sort of stuck in the middle, lead the way, and do oversight, more of which later. This sort of just summarises it in a slightly more easier to understand chart, sort of no lines on it, just gives who does what. But the second line of defence is risk oversight, and group risk in the HBOS example is only a subset of that. We focus on various risks, but group finance and some of the operating officers' functions also do that sort of second line of defence. It does take some time getting around it. It's fair to say that the annual report's very helpful. It was then pointed out to me once I joined the organisation, yes, Roger, the annual report says that, but the reality isn't quite there yet. And as with everything, I totally agree with Colin, we've had this structure in place for 3 to 4 years, rather like any plant which you leave in your garden for 3 to 4 years. It needs a bit of pruning every now and again. We're in the midst of a prune currently as to what should be done where. Certain elements of duplication have arisen, which don't help matters at all, although you've got to be very careful you don't prune so brutally and leave thumping great holes. Although at the same time, there's a strong focus these days on the first line of defence, that ordinary management's got to do the right things at the right time in the right way. We're not there as a comfort blanket for them. What's my role actually involve? So here I am, stuck in the centre, and how do we operate it this way? Whilst this is what's there in HBOS, I suggest that for many CROs or people in the risk functions, these items are going to be around somewhere. It all depends where you fit them in your particular structure. I'm supposed to provide policy guidance and establish minimum standards for conduct of insurance risk management activities throughout the group, and the same for investment risk. In HBOS speak, insurance is general insurance, investment is life insurance. So that's the first thing. When you first see my role, I thought, investment, that's sort of pretty wide-ranging, but investment is actually life insurance in our speak, I think, plus OEICs and UCITS as well. We operate via a series of risk policies, so for Solvency II, I think on this part, we're probably reasonably okay, actually. There's not many parts I can say that on, but for this one, we're okay. We've got these policies in place. We've got to ensure that each division has risk policies around, which fit with the insurance risk policy. We also have market risk policies and credit risk policies. These policies are more than just nebulous words. They consist of some hard-defined numbers, which suggest what the maximum appetite can be for certain areas. So bankers in particular love looking at basis points difference. So if basis points change by 25, 50, 100, 200, what's the impact on the bottom line? I feel I've learnt a lot from sitting on some committees, which frankly are, for 90% of the time, are absolutely no relevance to me at all, apart from enhancing my CPD and all-round knowledge. And I think there is a large amount we can learn from the banking side. The banking side, I think, can learn from us as well. And we shouldn't just think that, you know, we're two totally separate spheres. Certainly the view that, well, their banks, we're insurers, we'll do our own thing. Certainly on credit risk, it's quite interesting to see the difference of views between our own credit people, where, of course, that's our expertise in HBOS, and on the insurance side, where we have to have credit policies for various things there. We don't necessarily line up totally. And it's interesting, the conversations there. Well, we operate this way because we do. Oversight's a key part of the role, but again, that's sort of, what's oversight mean? I mean, very crudely, I'm told, Roger, an assessment of you and your team at the end of the year is going to be, I'm going to speak to the divisions and say, do you think Roger's team added value on the oversight? So going through it for pure form, at times you need to do it, but you've got to try and sort of see, well, how's that adding value to people there? Monitor compliance with insurance investment risk management standards. And then your limits incorporated. That really sort of links in with the oversight, sort of, you know, what's the appetite, what can they do, what can't they do, where's it come from there. Functional leadership, again, try and sort of lead the teams there on our particular side of the risk. It's very hard because there's no sort of pure teams only focus on this. It's generally what you actually call the actuarial side. We link in on both the life and the general insurance sides. They're the ones we sort of speak to and link with. Do they themselves see themselves involved in risk? Some, yes, because it's actually in the department's title, but others, it's part of the day job. So yes, it's embedded, but no, it's not, because they didn't think more of their primary part of the day job rather than the risk part there. Similarly to Colin, emerging risk is key. It's nice to know of the risk of yesterday, today, possibly tomorrow, but the one sort of 6 months, a year's time, they need to be looked at. Group risk is a clear place to do them. Chief Risk Officer is a clear area to look for them at. But it's whenever push comes to shove, that's the item that gets shoved out of the back of the queue so you can get everything else done. Yet actually, that's possibly the area where we could add the most value. Then finally, at the end, independent view on where the group is. So I'm in a sort of theoretical type role, got to know what the business is, know how things put up, stack up, and try and sort of lead from that. I believe that within that, I can still lead on ERM. I can still set the standards and say, well, this is how I want it to do. Obviously, working closely with banking colleagues, in terms of HBOS, I'm, 10% in any which way you count, 10% profits, risk capital, the whole works. So banking colleagues are doing similar. Banking's already got its Solvency II, so-called ICAAP, Basel II. Not quite the same, it's different, but the end game is about the same. I can recall giving my then boss a presentation on embedding enterprise risk management in the business, and this presentation, you didn't need to be an insurance specialist to follow it. It was the same principles for banks and insurers. So you can do it. It's the number crunch in the black boxes you need to be experts in each. And so the underlying principles are there. It's a question of how can I ensure the insurance side keeps alongside the banking side, if not in places actually leading it. What do I need from my team members? Which is, you know, do I need them to be actuaries? Knowledge of insurance, both in life and general, goes without saying. Actuaries, I'd be very nervous not having an actuary on the life specialist side. On the general insurance side, I'm sure there are some general insurance specialists here, I know full well that many of the best technicians and understanders of the business are not actuaries on the general insurance side. They've got the number skills, soft skills, and there's other skills there, but they don't have to be actuaries. So, as it happens, I think all my team members are members of the profession, but not all qualified. Communication is key. In the risk world, I think, again, following on from Colin, there is a place for the pure techie who has the best model of the world seen, and possibly in an appropriate environment, they work. But without the communication skills, we're nothing. You've got to have the good communication skills there. We've got to be able to explain what we're doing, see the wider picture, not just to the techie actuaries, but to the wider world. This is actuaries of the third kind, I think, as Peter Clark called them. We need respect and acceptance from key stakeholders. Again, you shouldn't be, if risk only operates on the basis, we're risk, we're powerful, we have the right to say no, we've lost the plot. We've got to gain respect of people. You need robust discussion to and fro on both sides. At times, there'll be times when you don't mutually agree, but all sides should agree, know where that is and respect the fact the other side has come there and where it's coming from. The challenges in the team, explaining market risk and life insurance accounting to bankers is one. I suppose you could put non-exec directors as well, unless your non-execs are particularly well qualified. We do have a different set of risk metrics in the insurance side and the banking side, and it's trying to sort of rationalise, well, should this be the case, yes or no? It's very easy to say, well, yes, it should be, because we're insurance, they're bankers, go there. But actually, when it comes down to it, I'm moving to the no camp. Not just to please my masters and get majority voting in my risk colleagues, but actually, we're looking at the same risk on both sides, so why have different metrics to look at it? And insurance accounting is sort of a red herring, which actually isn't one. Given I have a remarkably small team and I've got no models, persuading divisions to provide information and getting access isn't necessarily easy, but that's, I think, comes with group. As someone once said to me, Roger, you've got two problems in your job, group and risk, and that's what you work. Again, as I said earlier, you know, I'm not there to provide an extra source of competent staff for divisions, but at the end of the day, we're a team together, we've got to work together. There comes a time when I say, do you want some of my team to help on this? Because we know for what, there's certain things have to be done. If it's a choice between a Section 166 or me providing some resource to the division, it's a pretty easy answer. It's my resource is available there, and we manage it accordingly. So it's a question of, part of my challenge has been almost working out what we should do, how we can move it forward, both in the current world, in the hopefully very sensible Solvency II world, although there's still a large number of battles to do on that one, and managing to move us forward on the risk. I think that's all I have to say, if I remember the slides I've given correctly. So I'll happily sit down and take questions or have discussions.
Thanks, Colin and Roger. Right, is there a burning question from the floor, or should I take the pre-selected questions that I've so diligently prepared? Okay, I think I'll put Colin on the spot to start, actually. what was interesting for me, Colin, was the fact that the chief risk officer role actually almost was only formed post-demutualization. Was that just coincidental, or have things changed, let's say, between a mutual and the shareholder-driven company?
The role has existed for some time. It was really my taking it on that we gave it the name chief risk officer, but there had been a risk function probably for 5 or 6 years pre the demutualization date. Had a number of individuals operated in that function, picking up a very small group risk team with compliance activity. And I think probably just as I moved into that role, a feeling that the importance of the risk function in the life assurance industry was really gaining a degree of momentum, and that trying to position that role and position myself in that role with that enterprise-wide risk view was an ideal time to do that. And I think probably across the industry it's been sort of at a similar time that this has been happening, that the focus on that ERM role has been emerging. Now, there have been some companies that have been working in that way for 5, 6, 7 years, but I think it's a relatively new phenomena. People are picking up that CRO title across the industry and trying to drive that view.
Anyone? Yeah, Shane.
Question for Roger. You described a very purist three-line of defence model, perhaps more so than you did, Colin, though maybe you didn't go into that detail. I was just interested in your definition of oversight, where you did talk about looking at the effectiveness and so on of the business unit risk management. But what about the actual end result of it? You know, if there's a difference of opinion as to, you know, the extent or nature of a risk, how does that work? How does that get resolved? Whose opinion is it that eventually gets reported to the main board? Is it yours or theirs?
Can be both. At the end of the day, I have editorial control of what comes out in my department's name. If there are differences, which there often can, certainly the early stages there can be differences, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, I think it's obviously with sort of a cascading approach, the team doing the work often believe that in order to be respected you have to agree with everything told to you, so it's very hard for them to come in and say, well, actually we don't like what we see here, where is it here? And similarly the other side, the division won't be too amused to be told, well, this doesn't appear right. So at times there can be disagreements. I can go straight through and say this is my view of it. If the division, but I try and base that on full facts. So just us pulling a view out in the middle of the air doesn't do anyone any favours. So we believe ABC, we're seeing DEF, there's a clear gap here, here and here, therefore in our view this is the assessment here. We have the fairly traditional RAID system, so red, amber, yellow, green, which we have to attach to everything. That's both the individual oversight level, and also we currently combine them together in some magical way to come up with a total colour, a single colour for the management of risk within the division, which we are challenging internally. We're not convinced it's necessarily the best way of doing it. And the conversation I had today said, well, we spent more time on arguing over what the single rating was than actually the underlying issues. So it's where the respect comes in, because if the people respect the team and that you put the work in, then if you're saying we think this, this and this, and it could be there's a clear divergence of views, which is fine, both sides can say that, that's not a problem. But often I've had more agreement than I've had disagreements on what I'd call initially contentious ones there. But yeah, you're right, ultimately it can lead to, well, division saying we don't buy this, and group risk saying, well, no, we're sticking on this there. It can lead to that, but if it does happen, it's well debated in advance and both sides know where they're going to come from. But the danger in group risk is that you actually compromise to not cause upset, and actually in the current climate we're being encouraged even stronger to be say what you think but back it with the evidence, which I think is a reasonable stance.
I think there's an interesting calibration as well that happens probably as a new CRO goes into role, interacts with different people and business units over time, and you find your own position almost in terms of how you assess a risk and how worried you get about particular risks and how you want to communicate them. Some of the internal stuff, yeah. Such and such, a business manager will rate something as 9 out of 10 and Colin will rate it as 4 out of 10. People need to get a feel of where people are calibrating risks over time, and I think perhaps it's only something that will happen as you build those interactions and dialogues that you get a common feeling both as an individual and with the people you're communicating with on the board as to, you know, what issues do they want to hear about? Do they want to hear things at a particular threshold? And I think it does evolve over time, and the relationship with the business units will evolve over time as you sort of get a feel for what they need to be bringing to you and when they need to be drawing attention to risk issues with what degree of priority the business should be giving to those.
Thank you very much for your presentations. Very interesting. I had a quick question for both of you. Are you currently recording all of your operational risk events and near events? And if so, are you sharing them with your colleagues?
Yes and no. Which is, yes, we have, as part of the insurance operation, as part of the HBOS bank, we've got a advanced model approval model on op risk, which we use for our op risk capital for the banking ICAP, and we calibrate it to fit for the ICA approach as well. So therefore, we do record it there. Do we share it with colleagues? Yes, but I think our problem's been we spent so much time on getting a perfect system in place to get the model approval that on some of the embedding of it and using it to aid the business, we have some work to do still. So it's a classic example of having quite a good model, and the techies love sort of calibrating it and seeing what comes out, but then how are we using it to manage the business? We can improve on that. And why it was a sort of a straight no was we have recently withdrawn from the ABI's ORIX scheme because we found that we were putting all the data in and not getting anything back at all. And so there was a limit to our generosity on that particular one. So that's generally it, but I think it's a painful process to go through. I think you've got to look, if you start collecting the data, you've got to work out, okay, I'm collecting it, but then where's my feedback loop to the business on this? What's it telling me about the business? Because if you ask our guys, well, how can I reduce my op risk capital? They'll say, I can tweak the model here, which is kind of the wrong answer.
I think our experience has been much more focusing on the operational risk processes to help manage and control operation losses rather than the quantification piece, and I think the banks may have gone further down the advanced quantification of operational risk, and it sounds like in the HBOS case there has been a lot of activity in that area. We've done much less, and probably the quantification would be much less sophisticated, but I think the degree to which we share across the organisation and the business units through a variety of mechanisms, the events that have occurred, the issues that have arisen, and the cross-learning that we can get from that is quite high. So we would, within what is now an operational risk forum that brings in all the risk functions from the different business units, discuss every month, amongst other things, all the operational loss events that have occurred, share that information, get learning, and see if there's look across us to different areas in the business, and then escalate up to the more senior management forums, those that are most significant, where there's learning to be made. And again, we do use ORIC ourselves and share it with the industry effectively, so the data is there and available ultimately through that process.
Less questions than commentaries in support of both speakers. Absolutely fantastic speakers, I thought. I'm a CRO myself, so I thought I'd share in the same spirit, I'd share some of my experiences. And I'm just picking it, I made notes as we went along. So Colin mentioned, how do you engage the board on capital management and risk-adjusted performance metrics? The breakthrough for me was the first time I did an analysis of change from one year to the next of the return on equity. And such and such a division dipped, and the next day the line manager was hauled in front of the director and me and asked to explain to him, why aren't you measuring this risk much more accurately? And by the end of the week, all the other line managers were queuing at my department door to say, any other tricks you've got to help us with? So that made a big difference. Then I think it was Colin said, embed an adverse scenario early enough in your planning process. So what we've done in my firm is business continuity exercises are not system breakdowns and bombs and fires, they're old hat. What we've done in the last year, we did a solvency threatening event, which in our case is a big hurricane, that was the first one, and the guys had a day to work it out in the room with the managers disappeared because we were off on a business trip. Then later we said, what if the cost of reinsurance is going to double in 3 months' time and you can't buy it? What are you going to do? And again, they had a day to produce a solution to that. And at the end of that, there were some quite big policy changes, which they thought through for themselves, which was really fascinating. On range of risk appetites, I've just been taken over by a new firm, and they ask us for 6 different risk appetites, and I won't go into the details, but essentially they want to know the appetite for policyholder loss, i.e. regulatory intervention. They want to know the appetite for shareholder loss, i.e. would they have to recapitalise in extremity, and then they want many risk appetites around missing the plan by 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 years standards. And 6 appetites is now, we produce those standards regularly without thinking about, without blinking off the same curve. And then you mentioned making your solvency two and being preparing in time. Our thought process has been the following. If you want to get sign off in 2011, you've got to have had it running for 2 years in reality. So plan 09 and Q4 09, plan 10, Q4 10 to show the actuals. So we're actually trying to make our plan 09 ready to run the internal model approval through. Because we think we need to practice it twice before we take it to the regulators. then I think it was Roger said, do the departments think you've added value? The CEO sits down with me and the department heads and said, do you think risk management added value? But the first conversation went like this. The guy said, mumble, mumble. So the CEO said, well, show me your risk then. And the guy had a small piece of paper and he said, well, the CEO said, well, where are your objectives before you can measure the risks? And the guy was sent off, and as I said, many of the other line managers came back saying, oh, we need to document our objectives to document our risks. And again, it was a behaviour change because the support came from the top, I think is the message there. And then I think it was Roger said, the risk officer said, encouraging units to take more risk if they are underutilising the capital. Not only to underutilise the capital, but if our tail risk needs diversification, if this line of business over here drops by a third, we lose diversification, and that's a real pain in our capital model. So I'm actually going around to certain units saying, we need more of your risk, we need more of your risk. Well, it's not me, but it's me through the executive management team. So I do feel that... If you get the shareholders engaged, get the senior management engaged, then a lot of the things trickle down much more easily.
This is Madhu Acharya from Bournemouth University. From the presentations, actually, there are two things emerged in my mind about the new form of risk management. One is risk management as a tool or a technique, where the actuaries are the best person in the insurance sector. Another is risk management as a process and a system, where mostly the auditors usually play the role. And within these two roles, when they merge together in the enterprise risk management framework, I see there are three roles for the CROs. I'm not sure where the CRO fits. One is risk observer, where they actually observe the risks throughout the organizations. Another is risk takers, where they take the risks. And finally, the risk manager or communicator, where they actually manage the risks in a holistic basis. In your experience, where the role of the CRO fits in three areas, risk observer, taker, or risk communicator?
I'll kick off then. Have a go at that one. If I got your terminology right, risk observer, risk taker, was it risk manager was the last one? Is that right?
Sorry, I can hear. Sorry, can you repeat it, please?
Your three categories, was it risk observer, risk taker, and risk...
And the risk manager or communicator.
Risk manager and communicator,
yeah.
I certainly don't see it as the risk taker. I think that's the difference between the first line and the second line. The first line is where the risks are taken, where the judgments on the risks occur, and it's down, as Roger said, and I think it's similar in our own model, the three lines of defence. First line is there, taking the risks, making the judgments... and they are responsible as the first line of risk managers as well. We are there as a CRO and as a risk function to put a framework in place which helps and facilitates line management to run their risks effectively, to understand their risks, to communicate through the organisation, and hence get better outcomes for all concerned by having advanced techniques through the organisation for the management of those risks. So risk observer isn't a terribly appealing term. I don't think I would call ourselves that, but in a sense we are there looking at the risk profile and very much communicating that profile to those that need to know. So at the end of the day, it's my job to make sure that senior management and the board of the organisation do have a complete and accurate picture of the risk profile and all the risks that the organisation is exposed to, and doing that in as complete and as fair a way as possible so that understanding is there. I want to get a framework which helps them understand and manage those risks. Tools like the setting of risk appetites is critical to that, so we're actually drawing out of senior management what risks they are prepared to take, so there are conscious decisions taken rather than accidental risk exposures happening within in the organisation. And I do see a significant degree of risk management taking place. Both the team will be heavily engaged in opportunities to manage and mitigate risk, either through helping implement hedging strategies, which may either happen in the business unit or with the help of the central function. looking at reinsurance techniques across the organisation, and in our recent large transaction, the group team was heavily involved in conjunction with the business unit in making that $6 billion transaction happen. I think we'll be constantly looking across the risk profile and looking at ways to identify risk that isn't appropriately rewarded and taking action as a result of that, but also being almost the oil in the organisation that looks at one set of risks in one part of the group and another set in another part of the organisation. Are there ways of optimising that? And also moving into quite strategic areas in terms of looking at the range of risks we're exposed to and thinking, are there other areas that we could enter into, take additional risks where the diversification benefits would be substantial to us compared to other organisations, and we can get a better risk-adjusted return for the organisation as a whole?
Not much to add from Collins, apart from I do see our role as to bring to management the board's attention when insufficient risk is being taken. So I'd almost say we can suggest becoming risk takers. Currently, if you look at general insurance, then some companies got a surprise last year when it rained and they got some claims. Everyone thought they were reinsured. Well, they were, but you know, there was a first amount we had to take ourselves. And therefore, people say, well, you know, we don't need to take this. We should reinsure more so we have less volatility there. And it's almost then you have to come in on the reverse and say, well, no, you're here to take risk. If you don't take risk, you don't make any money. Now, yes, there's some financial arbitrage potentially available there, I accept. But at times, you do need to look at, are people, if they have a risk appetite, are they using it? And if they're not, you either use it or lose it. So it's, if you're not up to it, then why not? And otherwise, we'll just take it away and pass the risk capital across to someone else who's prepared to use it. That's pretty advanced stuff, I accept. But I do think we are in a position to sort of remind people that we're here to take risk. And so we're not here to say, well, watch what you're doing. We're here to say, well, can you expand a bit more, please? Because you've got the capacity to do it, and we're keen for you to do it. Why aren't you doing it?
Oh, thank you both for your presentation. I have a different, slight remark to your presentations. You tend to talk about risk, but there is a part of the loop that is missing, because the risk is a dynamic function, and it seems to be dependent upon the decisions that you take at the start of the period. So in a sense, what I'm getting at is, how do you reconcile the investment management decisions at the CIO level and the calculation of the risk at the CRO level, and how do you combine the two? Thank you.
I'll attempt on that one. It's not part of my core expertise. I'll stress that at the start. I think if you believe you have a disconnect between a decision someone is making and what risk is looking at, then the first thing to do is sort of try and get back to basics between both sides and work out what is the risk, how do we measure it, and then what do we expect to return on it. I think if you can do that, that's fine. If the problem is that someone's made some decisions, they're not being followed through correctly, that's clearly operational, so you go through it that way. So I think if there is a disconnect between what the business has said, in this case you've said it's investment, and then what the risk side is looking at, then there seems to be a gap somewhere in knowledge and understanding, or just straight sort of comprehension of what's supposed to happen, in which case speak urgently there. And that's the best I can manage, I'm afraid, on that one.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, I think. Probably made easier for myself in my own organisation, where I guess a lot of the investment decisions are policies and strategies are taken within a unit-linked fund, where the policyholder takes the risk and return. And in the majority of the risks that we have are effectively managed in a relatively conservative way, where we're largely hedging the risk. So it's not a situation where, you know, we're getting at all, you know, a CIO coming along and say, wouldn't it be great if we didn't hedge any of these risks anymore? We've very much got a relatively limited appetite for large losses of the type that were incurred in the earlier parts of the decade. But I think it's a fascinating question when you start thinking through into perhaps the investment banking sector and the larger risks and larger amounts of capital that would be exposed there that a CRO-type role would need to deal with. And I think always in these issues, you've got to say that, back to the respective roles, it's the line management that are making the calls on this, and it's my job to really get clarity and have independent view on the extent of risk that they are bringing. And if I can communicate effectively to the board in a complete manner the exposures that this strategy is bringing, then I think my job is largely done, and it's then for the board to make the judgment, are they happy taking that risk, which the other professional says is a good risk to be taken at the current time. And the challenge may come if my quantification of the risk is rather different from the CIO's. The CIO may be perhaps more bullish about the scenarios that face them, and maybe that is something we've seen over the last year in a lot of the banking markets. People didn't quite see through to the depths with which a scenario could evolve over that relatively short period of time, and then the risks have emerged as rather larger than had been expected.
Without in any way trying to target either Halifax or Standard Life, no, really I'm not, I was surprised not to hear more of consumer risk. One of the biggest problems, I would have thought, for financial services organisations is the consumer risk, the customer complaints, which are so badly handled. They get huge publicity, very, very bad publicity. I can think of one very large organisation, neither of yours, who seems to operate on a Ryanair basis. All complaints vanish into the ether. Is this part of the CRO's remit to try and make sure that the consumers understand they are being listened to and dealt with?
Yeah, I think the consumer elements and the reputational elements for the organisation, I think, are quite deeply embedded within the framework. So those consumer risks and the data that we get on issues like complaints do come into the operational risk framework primarily as risks to the organisation that are measured and we're trying to identify and manage as effectively as possible. I think we're helped with that with the regulators' TCF initiatives during the course of the year, which is pushing forward an increasing focus on getting good management information on consumer risks, and also setting a series of objectives, which, as I said, the CRO role is important in terms of its regulatory aspects in trying to help the organisation. Again, it's first line of management that must commit to getting great customer outcomes, but on the other hand, it's my role to make sure that we meet the regulatory outcomes, and together, hopefully as a team between the first line and the second line, we will achieve the good consumer outcomes and manage the negative consequences of that, because we ultimately as an organisation believe that happy consumers will be the lifeblood of the organisation, help us to be successful, and managing complaints will be an area where we got great information about how we can improve. So very much is a focus and is in there.
Now, I mean, very similar to Colin, I mean, responding to complaints is the primary division's role. And there's not a sort of centralised group function there. Yes, my group colleagues in business risk, in fact, do look at sort of how we're managing that particular one and link to the regulator. I do wonder, in fact, I hope that if we sort of expand the risk appetite concept wider than just the pure numbers which the actuaries love computing, that actually you can bring it in, I think, with quite some strength into the customer complaints area. So what's our appetite for complaints? Is it zero, which some people might say it is, or is it actually we'll accept one in a thousand? I don't know what. And what's our appetite for responding to them quickly or paying up? You can use the whole risk infrastructure, I think, to help you out in that domain. It comes into there. But yes, it's as with Standard Life, it's complaints are important to us, or resolving them. Ideally, you don't have any, but if they come in, yes, they should be handled fairly. TCF is quite clearly there, but at the end of the day, it comes down to first line management being responsible for them, and the second and the third lines need to be aware of what's happening and are they dealing with it in an appropriate fashion.
A question for Roger, please. With Basel II and the risk-based capital framework has been in place for banks for a couple of years already, and it hasn't worked very well. Now the insurance companies, I mean, obviously it hasn't worked very well, now the insurance companies are preparing to put in place Solvency II. So, you know, why bother? Because it's slightly similar or quite similar. Are there some lessons that the insurance companies can learn from the banks in terms of risk management?
Yes. The fact that something which is 80% good and has 20% of sort of areas which need to be improved doesn't mean to say you throw the whole thing out. You lock into the 80% which works and do what you can to improve the 20%. Solvency II is clearly, under any reasonable definition, infinitely better than Solvency I, which we have today. So we should move forward on Solvency II. Does it cover everything possible? Almost certainly no, because we don't know what everything possible is. We're into the unknown unknowns territory, I'm afraid, there. But what we, the bank, has learned from Solvency, from Basel II, ICAAP, in for Solvency II, is start early, get your work done. Start it early, because you'll probably finish then just about on time. Communicate, set up firm guidelines up front as to what you want to achieve from it. And yes, it's modelling only models what you ask it to model. So be very careful how you sort of use your models, what you're doing there. Speak carefully, because I want models to be approved, but conscious they can't necessarily cover everything, so I don't want an add-on formula from the regulators. But yes, I mean, it's as we learn information, we should add it to what we're doing. But it should, the fact that Basel II has had some well-publicised weaknesses shouldn't mean we throw everything out and say, oh, we can't do anything. We've got to move forward in a progressive fashion. I think Solvency II does that, as Basel II has done for the banks. But yes, it needs tweaking, and I'm sure we will tweak Basel II, as indeed Solvency II will doubtless get tweaked.
And I think it's very positive, the degree of convergence we're seeing between all the different types of financial institution, where we're getting increasingly organisations like both Rogers and my own that have got a mixture of types of business, both general insurance, life assurance and banking businesses, and increasingly we're getting a consistent framework that in principle is heading towards the same type of analysis, type of numbers that our boards and management will hopefully understand in a broadly consistent manner. Yes, some of the detail may be different between the different parts of it, but at the highest level it's all very similar, and I think, you know, it must make a lot of sense to operate that sort of analysis across the organisation. Our own experience in the insurance front, I think, has been that the ICAS regime has really helped with the transparency and visibility and communication of risks to boards in a way that other techniques beforehand didn't do, and it's really set out in a consistent framework all the key risks, help the board engage with them and help them decide whether they're comfortable with those risks that they're exposed to.
Thank you for two good presentations. Mine is a more general question, and I'd like you, both presenters, to shed some light on how success of the CRO role is typically measured in your organizations.
Good question. I know what failure is. I know what just about meets expectations is, but yes, this is a conversation I had at my own appraisal discussion with my boss, who's the group risk director. You know, what does really good and excellent look like? It was hard, actually. Both of us found it was hard there. I think it's we have the advantage of being in a group function in a bank, which means we possibly have more stable bonuses, but we don't get the excesses of others, perfectly deservedly, in the banks get, or possibly some of the bigger deficits they have there. I think it comes down to respect, do the job you want to do, keep fine-tuning the work you do to fit with the environment. So don't just do one model, you know, come in, create a new model, and then keep that for the next 10, 20 years. Keep fine-tuning it. Keep going back to basics each time. Say what works now, what doesn't work. Keep on top of it. And also have the business feeling that, yes, group risk function has added me value. I think you have to be prepared to almost have 360 degrees with your customers and on all sides as to say, well, did we add value or not? I think if you can get, yes, you added value, and I think you have to assume people answer that honestly. You don't add value by just agreeing with everything they say. I think, you know, the level you're dealing at wouldn't do that. But it is a hard one to say, what is superb success? What justifies the risk, heads of risk getting million-pound bonuses? Very hard one. But it does depend on the culture and the style of the company you have and how much direct exec authority you have as well.
I mean, I think in terms of success, there's probably positive and negative aspects to it. You know, what are the negatives? I guess what's going to lose me my job is going to be, I think, risks emerging that the board were just unaware of, where there was nothing coming up from the risk function to identify that we've had an exposure in this area. It hits them as a total surprise, and they're asking, you know, where was the risk management function across the organisation in terms of preparing us for this potential eventuality? Now, hopefully it won't get there, and we can focus on the more positive aspects of it in terms of the value added that we deliver around the organisation. And there, I think it's into using more advanced techniques to really optimise the risk profile, to make sure we're getting the maximum return on each of the risks that we run, that we don't have unrewarded risk in the organisation, and that senior management and our external stakeholders see that the organisation manages its business effectively. It builds a portfolio of businesses that are optimised from a risk perspective, that it enhances the return, it can respond quickly to changes in circumstances where potentially businesses no longer can achieve the returns that they would be wanting to achieve, or the risk exposure has increased substantially. The organisation is able to respond quickly and effectively to that. So hopefully more of the future will be in the positive territory, where we are looking at that optimization of risk and reward for the organization and providing a framework for the company to achieve that successfully.
My question is about risk appetite and risk strategy. In your experiences, how advanced is the risk appetite development process in the organization, and how embedded is it within the divisions in terms of the sort of everyday running of the business?
Well, start off then. We've got a wide range of policies across the organisation, some 50 different policies, which people feel is an awful burden at times, but I think nearly all of them, when you look at them, are necessary as the organisation. Each of those have got a statement of risk appetite associated with it. Some of them are qualitative statements about our approach to risk in that particular area, but they're setting a tone from the top in terms of how we feel about a particular risk, be it customer detriment risk or financial crime risk. They'll be setting out areas where there may be very limited appetite for any adverse events, to the financial areas where there's a hard quantification of our appetite at a particular probability level with a particular financial number. And against each of those appetites, we can measure our exposure on a regular basis, probably not as frequently as I would like, but we can measure those, and we can make sure that at each point in time we're within those appetites, and there will be regular reporting if those risk appetites are breached, so the board will be aware of it and action will be taken quickly. So there's certainly a framework there that's pretty comprehensive and pretty sensible across the organisation that I think does work. But inevitably with these things, you want to move forward to a different level and to make them more engaging for the organisation. I think the journey over the next number of years is to start adding new elements to the dialogue on appetite, because for the financial aspects, we very much set it at the tail of the distribution, as I said, looking at 1 in 200-year events and the amount of loss that would be incurred at that level. So the measurement systems and the communication with the board have been based on that tail of the distribution, with sometimes quite scary large numbers in terms of the exposures that you're running with at a 1 in 200 level. And I think increasingly over the next year or so, moving the dialogue on to the risks to other financial numbers that the board and senior management will be interested to. So what's the impact on profit of a 1 in 5 or a 1 in 10-year event to profit? What's the impact on dividend paying capacity? A series of different measures that I think will start engaging the board in a different manner and test their real appetite in a different sort of way to those risks. So I think that can then be embedded in a similar way to the capital measures that we've already got, but it might produce in some areas a different answer.
I think the answer depends on where you start from. If anything, HBOS almost has the things which Colin wants to do and is weaker on the things he already has. So, and the key to it is get the non-techies understanding that risk appetite is for them and speaking their language. And when we did a fairly major piece of work last year on bringing in risk appetite on a formal basis throughout the group, the one item which got all executives engaged was profits. Capital at that time, this was pre-August, got minimal blinks from them, whereas mentioned profit, they kind of got excited about profit. Profit meant something to them, usually pounds in their pockets. So our risk appetite to start with has been based very much on profit volatility, because that got them engaged. You could start the conversation, they could see where it was there. We've also got some, well, they're numerical, but they're not numerical items. Staff turnover rate's quite key to us. So we have that as part of a risk appetite. And so I think many of the things we have around the business are sort of targets, markers. Yes, slight tweak of the language, they're risk appetites. They're not called that currently, but essentially when you end up, they will be risk appetites. I'm old enough to remember balanced scorecards. So much of risk appetite is similar to balanced scorecards in many ways. Embedded in the business, I think that's a bit more than just risk appetite. That really is sort of moving the business from a sort of a potentially sales, profit, and keep things going approach to a sort of whole embedded enterprise risk management. And that sort of, that happens over time. I don't think there's any one event you have to do. You just keep doing a large number of small ones, like risk appetite, like return on risk. And then eventually you end up there without anyone realizing you've actually managed it. And they sort of do it more naturally.
As the implications of the credit crunch unpack, can you talk a little bit more about your role ongoing as we go through each new development? Is that?
You can. I'm not sure I can add much. I mean, I have colleagues who are much more actively involved, who happen to sit alongside me, much more actively involved in the credit crisis, in the credit crunch. As for what it means, obviously the key question is, what's it mean for the insurance sector? So some of the, there are interesting conversations happening between my banking colleagues who have certain views as to what our treasury colleagues should or shouldn't invest in, and with the insurance colleagues who advise the investment managers as to what they should invest in. And that's currently where there's a difference of approach. It's sort of, you can argue that irrespective of, if you mark to market, then actually in the insurance side, it's not a big problem because you mark to market your liabilities as well, so you can move your discount rate around on the liability side. But it's not quite that simple. I think there's some more biggies there. As if Andy Hornby, the CEO, said, okay, if Bank X goes belly up, what's the cost to me? We'd like to have a consistent answer there. So it's forced us to think more of those particular issues. And also it's opened my eyes certainly to the more direct things of funding and liquidity, whereas liquidity and credit as an actuary on the life side you tend to think were sort of irrelevancies which the FSA asks you some dumb questions on. But now you can see how they all fit in and come into play.
Yeah, I think as things evolve, they will have their natural cycle. And already from the investment management perspective, we will have active investment managers saying, are these assets now attractive? They've fallen so far in value. There's a number of distressed sellers. Is there an opportunity actually on the positive side to start making returns? And there the risk management function has a role of engaging with the risk takers in the business that want to generate excess return, to have that dialogue around, well, yes, that's your view now that things are moving, turning. Can we look at the potential downside risks that would bring? And are we happy as an organisation taking on some new risks in these areas that may be opportunities for a sector that was less impacted than a number of others by the impact of the credit crunch? But obviously very difficult to call an issue like this because, you know, is it easing off at the moment, or is this just a temporary lull that we're having and there's worse to come? And I think the risk manager always needs to look at the downsides of that potential scenario, that things could continue in a challenging format for quite some time to come.
It's a bit of a follow-on question to the question before last, so I apologise for not putting my hand up quickly enough. You are both involved to a greater or lesser extent, I think, in educating your board about the risks in the business. And the conversation we had about profitability was a part of that. To what extent do you think there's still work to be done on educating the investors and the analyst community about the true riskiness of insurance business? And do you think that could actually move towards a change in an expression of risk appetite on behalf of shareholders and therefore greater risk taking by insurers?
I think the whole of this topic is so new and potentially exciting that education to all interested stakeholders is appropriate and relevant. I think we'd be naive if we thought we can totally change how analysts will look at the industry by a decent bit of communication and presentation on risk. But the more information that they know is available in the market or the market is discussing, then I think the more we will have to brief them and keep them up to date and keep them informed. There may or may not be actuaries here who are actually analysts themselves and so have a part to play in that process. I mean, I find it personally very strange that HBOS is covered by banking analysts who don't appear to communicate with their insurance analysts at all about the insurance side, which is... So they focus more on the banking side and we just put some insurance stuff in to sort of remind them of the, sort of the size and what the insurance group offers then.
Yeah, I think there's inevitably a lot more communication that needs to happen. A number of organisations, I think, have been going out with risk management presentations to their investor community, but I think that will inevitably continue. It will be an area that's of a lot of interest, albeit in a sector that even just getting the numbers, let alone the risks, is very, very difficult for the external analyst to understand and appreciate. So undoubtedly there will be more to come in that area.
I mean, just a question from my side, because the floor is a little bit dead for both of you. I mean, how do you relate these new risk appetite numbers to what happened in the past where it wasn't being measured? Have I just killed the meeting?
No. I think in the past, we had a, depending on which precise risk appetite numbers we're talking of, but I think there was always a good gut feeling of what you expected and what you could accept. We didn't call it risk appetite, or you were able to manage your results such that you could hit any predetermined target in the good old days when you could account accordingly. I think we can have much more preciseness, we can target our aim much better, and we can be much more direct and decide what we want to go for. I mean, one weakness I've already seen in risk appetites is that people think it's a box-ticking exercise. They sort of come in with a number, which they don't believe in a month of Sundays, which is much stronger than 1 in 200, I think, that they'll hit it. So you have a sort of conversation with them then, and sort of try and tweak them downwards then. So again, it's part of the education process.
Yeah, I think a member of staff that left our organisation recently, I looked back at their career and the sort of when I joined the organisation, which was, get the year right, 1987, and we went through almost two decades of positive stock market returns, where over a period of 15 years or more, the average return on the stock market was 15% per annum or more, and 20% in some periods. And it really just was such a long period of excess positive returns that perhaps risk management just wasn't featuring in people's thinking to such a great degree, that any time there had been a hiccup in the stock market, it had been brief and short. And then as a life sector, I think every company went through that period from 1999, 2000, 2001, where we just got year after year of dreadful negative returns. And in fact, the whole period from 1999 till now, the average return on many markets has been barely positive. So it has been a pretty challenging environment with capital bases much less than they have been. So the need to focus on risk has been much greater than it was in the past. The tolerances are much less in terms of exposures, and I think many of the losses that senior management did see during that period of 3 years of very deep bear market are not things that they would want to see again. And hence, I think the real desire to put in these thresholds and tolerances which would be much tighter than they would have been in the past, because I think as actuaries we did have mechanisms to communicate risk in the past, but people were quite willing to discount the probability and likelihood of the very, very severe events that actually did turn out to happen. And all too often we do see in various sectors that we are getting an emergence of risks that appear to be pretty near the tail of our distributions.
Hi, thank you. Any other more comments or observations or questions? We've done particularly well. We've run over time, which let me out of a little bit of pressure here, because I'd run out of questions too. The one thing I just, before we close off, I'd just like to get a view from the audience that are here tonight. How many of you are currently involved in the risk management area within your company? So risk management as opposed to risk taking. Can we just have a show of hands? Thank you. The other thing that I would encourage you, I mean, this is part of the, as I said, the ERM practice area initiative. We have a risk management interest group as well that organizes these networking meetings. And we would appreciate your feedback on this meeting, firstly. And secondly, what other topics you'd like us to address? I mean, we aim to have a meeting every quarter. And obviously, as the constituency builds and as the interest in risk management builds, we'd like to get your views on what you'd like to be listening to and what you'd be like to have discussed in these sort of forums. All that remains is I'd like you to join me in thanking our speakers this evening.